session number 26546, reel 9.
Major Highfield, Reel 9. The next thing then is I would like to look at the move up for getting ready for the Battle of Marath in I think March, 6th, whatever.
March the 17th.
Thank you.
Based on my...
If you could tell us about the move up and the situation during the move up.
Yes, well, the regiment was without its... three-ton transport at Benin Airfield. Our transport eventually came back to us and we were told to get ready to move up. And then the order came to move. It was quite interesting crossing the Libyan Tripolitania border at Marble Arch. We then proceeded towards Tripoli and but there was a loop road to the south through Castel Benito, which was the main airfield there. And so we never went through Tripoli at all. And we staged a night and proceeded on in darkness. And I remember passing forward airfield. And we moved on throughout the night and got into a backup position about 6 o'clock in the morning and then moved further forward the next day. The plan began to unfold very quickly. 50th Division was to make a direct assault on the Marath line and... 151 Brigade would be in the front of it. In fact, the positions, the gun positions for the fire plan were exposed and therefore wrecked and only occupied on the night before the attack took place. I was gun position officer for D Troop, that's right. And the fire plan was an opening barrage. Barrages had come into fashion as the right tactic since Alamein. We had quite a lot of ammunition. We moved forward and occupied our position all right on the evening of the 16th of March, I think it was. And HR was in the darkness. I forget exactly which hour. And we had a gun program to fire of 400 rounds a gun. The ammunition supply was included quite a lot of boxes, which had been in storage in the, near Tobruk, and was dug up and forwarded to us. And we had, during the fire program, quite a number of misfires. When you're firing a time program, if a gun goes out of action, the other numbers one have to try and make up the fire between them. And in point of fact, on several occasions during the barrage, two guns were out of action with this untrustworthy ammunition.
What was the procedure of a misfire? Would you be aware of that? Or what would you actually do?
Well, you've got to wait 60 seconds before the drill starts, before you attempt to unload the gun, and then take the offending charge away and to a safe distance behind. Because of the of this making up, one of the things that went on as a long story tale in the regiment ever after was the numbers one competition to say how many rounds they fired at Marath on the opening barrage and concentrations. It reached figures of up to 600 at times. Anyway, the Durhams went forward, they got their objectives, and it was hard fighting. One of the divisions opposite us was called the Young Fascist Division. It turned out that they were young when Mussolini marched on Rome in the 20s. But behind them lay German armour. And the crossing of the Wadi Zigzaw, which was a turgid sort of pool and stream, was very unfortunately didn't stand up to the traffic. Some tanks got across to support the infantry, but no anti-tank guns got across. And the situation was not good, the other side. On about the second or third day, the counterattack came in from 15th Panzer Division, and gradually they recaptured most of the ground until 151 Brigade were very nearly back on their start line. Very disappointing. I believe afterwards the divisional commander and the CRA were both changed because of this failure to get, basically to get anti-tank guns across to support the infantry. This is a battle at which Ian English has given me quite a vivid description, in which he ended up being taken prisoner.
That's Ian English of 8th Battalion.
Of 8th Battalion, yes. Yeah.
DLI.
Yeah, DLI. And I was then told that one of the captains, battery captains, had been evacuated sick, and would I go across to another battery and take over Easy Troop as captain, troop commander, which I did.
Easy Troop is E Troop, obviously.
E Troop, yes.
Which battery was that? That was.
This was in 296 battery. We then moved to the centre of the line, where the Guards Brigade had put in an attack and suffered a number of casualties on mines. The enemy was now withdrawing because the left hook, which terminated in the Battle of El Hamma, was now proceeding and threatening the Axis rear. But I did experience the difficulty of the engineers with mines, because one engineer officer was forward trying to dig out a mine and giving a talk on the telephone back. These were wooden shoe mines, and after a bit we drove away a short distance and there was an explosion, and this gallant officer was killed trying to defuse this new type of wooden shoe mine. That was really the end of our party, our taking part in the Battle of Marath. The line moved up to Wadi Akarit, I think. No, that's not quite right. Moved up to the next defensive position, just the other side of Gabies. We were not involved in this. But we then moved forward up to the area of Enfidaville, just short of Enfidaville, where the New Zealand division was the frontline troops. We stayed there. This was a very formidable position. All our side of the southern side was exposed, and the hills rose straight up. There was one particular pimple hill called Takruna, T-A-K-R-O-U-N-A, and it really was a very exposed area. An attack was put in by the New Zealand division. We occupied the positions by night because they were so exposed. It went in and forward positions were taken. But very shortly after that, it was decided that it was the wrong place for the armies to attack. And the final assault went round on First Army front with combined divisions from both armies and terminated in the fall of Tunis.
Now, how are you getting on with Easy Troop, E-Troop?
E-Troop.
What state were they in when you got them? What was your opinion of them as a troop?
Well, by this time, our regiment were very experienced, all troops, and we, on the whole, throughout the war, were a fairly lucky regiment as far as casualties went, and the experience was considerable. It had taken me 3 years with the regiment before there was a possibility of my going up to be a troop commander. The GPOs were all experienced, and the only real trouble we'd had was in the retreat when I wasn't with the regiment, when most of 293 Battery were captured in the retreat. However, the plan was back to the Delta to get ready for the next move. And rather disappointing, the troops had this sort of feeling that they were fighting their way nearer to home, and we now had to turn round and drive 2,000 miles right back to Alexandria, to Sidi Bish.
That's where you went?
Sidi Bish camp. On the move back, when we were in Libya, orders came through for some of us to proceed on courses, and three of us in a 1500 weight took off and drove all the way back and through and up into Syria to attend a mountain warfare course.
Now, what do you remember about that?
Well, we averaged about 200 miles a day. We had our own supplies and a 1500 weight truck. And completed. It was clear that courses were important. And I also went later on down to do an assault landing course.
Well, tell us about the mountain warfare course first. What were you learning?
We were being taught of the rather slow and difficult operations that could occur in mountains. It all seemed very remote to us, having been operating in the desert. The sea landing course was done too, and then we began to concentrate, and the regiment moved from Sidi Bish to Suez.
Just before we go on, was there anything about the assault landing course that comes to mind?
I can't remember much now. It was to introduce us to the landing craft and the order of control. And going on from there, all the transport was loaded separately, and we were told that we were going to embark from Attica. Attica, that's it. Which is the top of the Gulf by Suez. It was very hot there in late June. And I had developed, unfortunately, a bad leg. Something had bitten me, and my leg blew up completely. The infantry did one exercise down the Gulf of Suez when I think live ammunition was fired over their heads. They then immediately fired live ammunition back, and I think that was the end of any further exercises that were imposed. But we all had to get as fit as we could. Very difficult in this hot weather. And the sea at Suez, where we bathed every day in the evening, was very tepid and not all that clean. Finally, we loaded up, and the doctor was allowed to have a jeep. My leg was still bad, but we arranged that I would go in his jeep to very close to the gangplank of the vessel, and I would only have 100 yards to walk to get on the boat, which is what in fact took place. We then pulled out and started moving up the Suez Canal, and almost immediately our health improved. Desert sores began to wane, and the sea air and the made all the difference. I remember when we got to Alexandria, we anchored for a bit, and looking at what I thought was a cruiser, or possibly, I thought it was a cruiser, it turned out to be a completely dummy vessel on the top with cardboard and canvas, a superstructure, but it would perhaps be sufficient to deceive enemy air photography. By this time, we pulled out, went round onto Alexandria.
What was the name of your ship? I should have asked earlier.
It was a British India boat. I can't remember.
Okay, no problem.
British India boat. And we now knew that we were going to attack Sicily and were issued with the Soldier's Guide to Sicily.
Now, what do you remember of the plans as they were told to you, the briefing you got?
The 151 Brigade, 50 Div, was going to assault on the beaches just south of Syracuse at a place called Avola. There was the D-Day convoy, and then there was a next convoy going in was D+3, and our boat was in the D+3 convoy. The guns had been loaded separately. The landing was successful, mainly Italian troops, and we, in due course, pulled into Syracuse Harbour alongside the Mole and debussed and marched out to a mile or so to an grove of almond trees, at which stage we were waiting to be married up with our unloading of the guns and other transport. During that day, we learnt the sad news that one of the ships carrying guns had been bombed by a fighter bomber and sunk. It turned out that these were one troop of one battery and one troop of our battery. E-troop guns were all right. However, the colonel gave the order that when the junior battery must give up its guns to the middle battery and make a complete thing. So our guns were passed over and we were left with nothing but our small arms sitting under the almond trees. The initial distances in Sicily were very great. The infantry had a lot of marching to do and had to secure the flanks. 5 Div were not an experienced division at this stage, and 50 Div were given the more inland tasks. And they eventually moved up to the area of Lentini after several quite severe engagements. One of the our sister regiment, the 124 regiment, was hit by fighter bombers on this manoeuvre, and a battery commander, a troop commander, were killed, and there was only one captain left in the battery, Captain Ramsden. It was decided that my battery commander, Ken Park, and myself as the troop commander, and a subaltern called Benyon for the command post, would be put up to replace temporarily these in the 124 battery.
124 battery or
124 regiment? Sorry, 124 regiment.
Do you know the battery you were going into?
I don't remember the name. So we, Ken Park and myself and the others, drove off up the road to Lentini, through Carlentini, and then the gun position we were to get to was halfway between Lentini and the Primosole bridge over the river there, in a very exposed forward position. When we got there, they had had Italian troops from the coast coming back through their gun position and had dealt with them. And we then took over the job. Ken Park and I drove up to the OP party, which was sited on one of these small hills very close to the Primosole bridge, which had in fact been one of the objectives of the parachutists, and which they had, I think they were called, I think it was Johnny Two was the code name for the parachutists who had tried to hold it, but German parachutists pushed them off. I occupied this OP over the next 4 days. For some reason, the wireless sets just seemed not to work at all. We had practically no communication back to the troop for some time. However, this was established, and in the end, Ken Park got the line people to lay a line to the OP. So my position was, I had excellent observation over the distance. Couldn't see anything in the dense vineyards the other side of the wadi, and had no communication with the forward infantry. However, I could report on enemy activity, artillery activity by compass and bearing, and I took over the OP during the afternoon and stayed up on the top throughout the night. This was the night that 8th DLI went across initially and formed a bridgehead. We watched with the firing and the Vera lights, and it was quite an astonishing display. It looked at times as if the buildings round the bridgehead could not survive. And we heard for the first time the high-speed machine gun fire of the latest machine gun. I think it was MG-42, which the German parachutists had. However, 8th DLI held out in a close bridgehead. During the daytime, the hill on which ROP was sighted was shelled periodically by long-range 170mm guns, which were out of range of anything that we had.
What was it like under that kind of shell fire?
It was rather hard ground on the top of the hill. I had sighted the OP about 200 yards away from the very crown, and we had dug, after some difficulty, a small slit trench about 4 foot deep. The top of the hill was a ranging point for this long-range artillery. And Ken Park came to visit me once or twice a day, until on the second day we were shelled for a further time. One round dropped behind the hill, one in front, and then we heard the next one coming and dive for the slit trench. The OPAC was in first, I was in second, and Ken Park was in on top of me, and the shell fell 10 yards away, perhaps, and the back of his neck was completely black from the explosion. He then told me, "I'm not coming to see you at the OP again for the rest of the campaign." The other artillery story was of these enormous 12-inch howitzers, fixed defence, coastal guns, which had been sold to Italy in the 1914-18 war. There was a troop our battery had occupied the position and taken over the guns. There were two guns on the position. There were a further two guns entrenched at Catania. Obviously, each knew to the last inch where the position was, and occasionally they would fire these guns. The drill on our troop, which I heard about later, was to load the gun and then fire it off, fire a second round and then a third round. As the rate of fire intense was 5 minutes to load, this meant that at 10 to 11 minutes after the first round being fired, you leapt into transport and drove off the position. The German counter-battery fire came down almost exactly 14 to 15 minutes after the first round was fired. However, eventually the desperate struggle that 151 had with the parachutists was won, and the line stabilised right the way across till the 78th Div came up in the middle, Americans on the far left. The final break was made in the middle by 78th Div, I think, at Century Bay, and we moved forward on the coastal route, really following a pursuit, following a withdrawal technique, which the Germans were very good at, withdrawing 1, 2 miles, 3 miles to the next village, and then you had to bump and make contact. And this is what happened all the way around the shoulder of Etna. I remember getting to a place called Giare, which was on the coast, past Catania, and the bridge in front was mined with little blocks everywhere. And the infantry had gone over in the morning, the usual withdrawal had taken place, and the brigadier we were working with 69 Brigade at this time. A Brigadier Cook Collis arrived to apprise the situation. A rather fearsome officer to meet. He asked immediately what was going on. He then turned to me, said, "Who are you?" I said I was the OP and OP officer and waiting for the bridge, which was mined, to be cleared. He said, "Get over." So I had no option, but I put my two signalers to walk over and then directed the driver very carefully to avoid the obvious concrete positions with the mines.